Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us again on today's Journal Club. Today, we're going to talk about the research that has been coming to light and being developed. We will, if you would advance the slide, Shane, you know, we will go through some of the state of the state updates and look at some of the new updates that have come out since the last time we spoke, which was last week, Thursday. So if we go ahead and proceed, I want to just show you where we're at in the country. This is from Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. And as of 8:39 this morning, our total confirmed COVID cases were 825,306. Unfortunately, we've had over 45,000 deaths currently at this time. When we look at the where Florida is really residing, we are now fast approaching a different mark. We're at 27,869 cases with about 867 deaths. So we've had a lot of people who are either still hospitalized or recovering. We'll talk a little bit more as we move through some of the research about some of the impacts that we're seeing with Florida. If we can go in, I want to just make sure I just look at the projections so that you see what's been happening. So we have seen a flattening of the curve. This is the United States as a whole, and it's been 5 days since the country as a whole has used the peak resources. We are still, as of April 22nd, we're seeing that we're probably going to require around 59,000 beds and 16,000 plus ICU beds. So we, you know, that range is still there, and there is still concern, especially as we start relaxing social distancing, as we're seeing that's going to be moving through the states. When we look at Florida, the good news is that we've seen a dramatic flattening of the curve. You know, we've saw that our peak resources were used 10 days ago, but we've seen that with social distancing, that curve and that peak has flattened out. This has led to some relaxation of some of our social distancing rules. I know that there have been opening of beaches and everything, and there's a lot of room for debate of whether that is the most appropriate thing to do. So we'll see. But as of today, we're thinking that we're going to need about 20,000 beds with 1,600 plus beds being ICU beds. So it's a little bit different. Doesn't give us in our space much room to relax, because what we're really anticipating is that we're going to be on those front lines of seeing the outbreaks. If we keep moving forward, CMS announced some new requirements, and this is the notification. So those requirements are coming soon, where it is requiring the facilities, whether they be SNFs or ALs, to be transparent about the cases of COVID-19 amongst the staff, as well as the residents. So if you proceed to the next slide, this is just the summation of what they're really describing. You know, I think we are all aware of situations where facilities haven't been reporting their COVID-19 cases or even suspected cases here in Florida. And this is actually happening across the country. So CMS came out with this ruling, and what we saw on April 19th was a full list of all the COVID-19 positive SNFs and ALs come down from our state on that day. So if you haven't seen that list, I believe the website is post it on our FAMDA COVID library. If it's not, we'll make sure it's there for you to view. It is very important for us to know and to track which nursing homes are reporting the COVID-19 cases. And unfortunately, I've known too many staff workers who didn't know what was happening in their facility, came and work, and now are hospitalized. So we really want to stay ahead of that. And I appreciate what CMS is doing to help us be more transparent. If we move forward, you know, there's also been some guidance from ACA and the National Center for Assisted Living Facility around nebulizer treatments for COVID-19 affected residents. I think this is pretty much information that we all know. And I think that this response really comes in from a lot of the physicians and a lot of the evidence coming through that we really should be careful about who we're offering nebulizer treatments to at this time because of the way this virus can spread, give it an aerosol. You know, so nothing really new here. It's just that it is an official recommendation that's coming through to really reassess the need for nebulizer treatments amongst those individuals who are being treated and cared for. So what I really want to spend the majority of our time today is around the literature. This is really going to be a very high yield review of some of the recent papers and cases that we've seen reported. Much of it, there's no true bias with any journal, you know, but I will say that certain literature is doing a better job of keeping us up to date. And it's not from the fact that they do things differently. I would just say that the content that they're getting is more substantial. I would really encourage if you're doing something, if you're seeing something, if you have any cases that you report and you write it up, I think this is the time where we really need to hear from each other and push out things that we're doing, whether it's a small sample size or not, because the issue that I'm seeing is that we still don't have enough information around what to do in our space. So the first study that I want to go through is, if you go to the next slide, it's a case report about immune thrombocytic purpura in a patient who had COVID-19. So this patient is a 65-year-old woman with hypertension, autoimmune hypothyroidism, and no COVID-19 exposure. 4-day history of fatigue, fever, dry cough, and abdominal discomfort. Following her admission, you know, they found that her white count was normal, her platelet count was 183, PTT was normal, and her fibrinogen level was at 5, and the normal range for that facility was 2 to 4. By day 2, they saw that her platelet count had dropped to 66,000. On day 5, it was 16,000, and by day 7, it was 8,000. They gave her IVIG, and she, in addition, had a bone marrow aspiration where they saw normal cellular activity, normal erythroblasts, normal granulite cells. And by day 9, her platelet count was at 2,000. You know, so this question was brought up actually last week where it was asked, have we seen any people who had just a low platelet count and not much else? And this is one of those cases where it really describes how low we can see those platelets drop. By day 9, as I said, her platelet count was at 2,000, and she required a platelet transfusion, and her only symptom at that time, her only other issue was that she had a frontal headache. The CT of the head showed subarachnoid microhemorrhages in the right frontal lobe. So it was just interesting that all of these things transpired in this case. And as we move through some of the other cases, we do see a trend. You know, it's not enough evidence and information to say whether COVID-19 was a causal factor, but I do think it lends itself to having more investigation. If you proceed to the next slide, this is just an image, and this is clearly the tichiae, we see the purpuric lesions on the patient's lower extremity. This is in the journal article from the New England Journal of Medicine. So it's a really good article if you have a chance, but this is just one of those examples of cases that we can probably, we are now seeing where there are other factors that are coming into play, and we really do need to do some more research around it. With that, we go to the next article, which is also from the New England Journal of Medicine, and this is coagulopathy and antiphospholipid antibodies in patients with COVID-19. And in this case, it starts off talking about a 69-year-old man with hypertension, diabetes, and stroke who presented with fever, cough, dyspnea, diarrhea, and headache. They noted that he had ischemia in his lower extremities bilaterally, and on his left hand, digits 2 and 3 were also ischemic. When they did some blood work on exam, they found that he had leukocytosis, thrombocytopenia. His PT and PTT were elevated. He also had elevated fibrinogen and elevated D-dimer. They noted that two other patients who were in the ICU with him also had the same symptoms, and so they looked at it and did a comparison of those other two, and what they found when they ran serological tests that the patients were positive for anti-cardiolipin IgA antibodies, anti-beta 2 glycoprotein IgA antibodies, and IgG antibodies. So, you know, it is still speaking of that coagulopathy that we've now heard so much about, but you know, still not enough samples, not enough of a sample size to really point to a causal relationship. But I will say our next paper, which comes from Lancet, describes what they were seeing with 183 patients. So this was, authors were Tang and his colleagues, and this is out of China, and they followed 183 patients consecutively and looked at what they were doing at time of admission. The concern was, do we give thromboprophylaxis? And what they noted was that out of this 183, 162 patients met the criteria for DIC. So when they saw that there was an increase in D-dimer, the mortality rate went up 18 times higher than those who had a normal D-dimer. And they're really making the argument about the necessity to give thromboprophylaxis based off some of these early findings that they saw in this hospital admissions of these 162 individuals meeting criteria for DIC. So in what we're now going to talk about, I just want to go through some of the investigations that we're currently seeing. So the first study, we're looking at the positive test results in patients who recovered from COVID-19. And this was, once again, a small sample size of 4 patients who were all admitted with a positive result and CT showing ground glass opacification. They each received Tamiflu, which we now know hasn't shown any benefit in COVID-19. After that hospitalization, these individuals were monitored at day 5 and day 13 with another test. What they found was that both of those tests came back positive. All of them were positive. And by day 4 to 5 following the first two tests, they were retested, and again, they came back positive. So this really speaks to how long are we going to see this virus in our system. What is interesting is what the authors are saying, that all of these patients at this time, by the time they had day 5 testing, day 13 post-hospitalization testing, and then day 20 and 21 day testing, they were all asymptomatic. But it brings into question, how long should we isolate these patients, and how long is the viral shedding period? There are currently some preprint, which means not non-peer-reviewed articles that are circulating, where they're suggesting that they're seeing shedding up to day 47 and day 49 post-symptoms. That's not peer-reviewed yet. It's not published. So we're still waiting for those studies to be completed, but it is an interesting question. If we continue on, you know, it brought it to another question that we've had a couple of times on our calls about co-infection. And much of the initial thoughts was that the possibility of co-infection was very low. This study was done in California, and it was done in the Northern California area, led by Stanford and the Stanford labs. And they looked at individuals who were given both a test for COVID-19 as well as non-COVID viruses. So they studied about 1,217 specimens were tested. Of those, 116 of those specimens were positive for COVID-19. Of the ones that were positive for COVID-19, 24 showed that there were an additional pathogen on board. They then looked at those that tested positive for another respiratory pathogen, such as RSV, rhinovirus, enterovirus, and they found out of 318 of those positive for another pathogen, 24 of those cases had COVID-19 positive samples as well. So really, you know, very small, not all of it is significant, but it does beg the question, do we need to do more testing and investigation around how the virus is transmitted, how we are seeing, if we're seeing that there is a possibility for a co-infection. I think a lot of that initial reporting, if you had a positive flu, don't test for anything else. And what this really shows is that there may be some reasons that we need to still test for COVID-19, which I think we're all at that same point. If you advance to the next slide, Shane. So this just really shows which of the other respiratory pathogens were also on board. We saw the highest was RSV and rhinovirus and enterovirus. So, you know, it just, you know, begs the question of, can there be a co-infection? This study was very limited to the geographical region of Northern California. So it really does, we really do need to see a broadening of these studies so that we can get more information and look at a better sample size for these cases. The next study is really about a search for the treatment. So we're going to start with, you know, the article that came out, I believe, oh my gosh, on Monday, from JAMA. It was a review of the pharmacological treatments for coronavirus. We know many of these things. We've already talked about it on our pharmaceutical management, that there are certain medications that we're utilizing. So I don't think it's anything that's unfamiliar. If you go to the next slide, I just want to point out, you know, of the three, there are 351 active trials now. So I think when we last talked about this, it was like 61, but now there are 351 active trials. And it's just interesting to see the way we're thinking about this. So I believe, my gosh, a few weeks ago, we talked about the lopinavir trial that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine that didn't show much benefit. We are always in, you know, since the FDA emergency authorization, and before that, we're talking about hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine because they inhibit viral entry. We have a lot of case reports where we've seen a positive outcome, and then maybe even more extreme cases where we've seen problematic outcomes because of the adverse side effects. To that point, I would say that there was a clinical trial that was ongoing in Brazil that had to be stopped because of the side effects and deaths associated with and deaths seen while they were treating individuals with chloroquine. The one that is probably gaining a lot of attention, the one treatment, is with remdesivir. So remdesivir is showing a lot of positive signs because of this broad spectrum approach to targeting RNA viruses. And we are seeing some good signs and some positive studies, so much to the point that the NIH is now has now sponsored a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial or remdesivir effectiveness. So more to come on that. You know, I thought this was a beautiful schematic to show you all the places where we thought these medications would really target. You can see that the hydroxychloroquine is inhibiting viral entry, and remdesivir inhibits the viral production. So it's just really interesting to get a broader picture of everything. As we go through, you know, to the next, I think we can keep moving forward, Shane. Yeah, that big grid, I will leave that to you guys to take a look through. It's just all of the trials, the summation of the trials. But I want to point out this article because this was in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it's a compassionate use of remdesivir for patients with severe COVID-19. So in this study, they looked at 61 patients who've had at least one dose of remdesivir. Of the 61, 8 had to be excluded because of various issues around samples and their condition. But we were able to really look into 53 patients who remained on the study. If you go to the next slide, you know, they really looked at the change in oxygen support from day zero when they received remdesivir over 18 days after receiving the first dose and over a total course of 28 days. So they were able to look at the cumulative incidence of clinical improvement, which is a score that they developed. You had to have two or more points on a 6-point scale or be able to be discharged. So that means that you weren't requiring more ventilation, you were stable, you know, no fever, no other symptoms. And if you met two or more of those, you were considered to be clinically improving. So by 28 days of follow-up, you know, they saw that the improvement was overall was 84%. If we go to the next slide, this real graphic is describing what happens with those individuals who are intubated on a ventilator versus the non-invasive ventilations. And non-invasive ventilation is high flow oxygen, increased O2 flow, those kind of things. When you think of invasive, you know, it is the traditional intubation on a ventilator. So there wasn't as much improvement for those individuals who were had to be placed on an invasive ventilator. And you know, there is discussion, I would say, more amongst the infectious disease and pulmonary community about when to place a patient on a ventilator. You know, they're trying to wait until it's absolutely necessary before putting them on the ventilator and pushing it out, because what they're seeing is that they could tolerate O2 saturations. These patients could tolerate O2 saturations in the 80s, the high 80s to low 90s, a little bit better. So they are trying to push out intubating them. The science around that, you know, it's really subjective that some of the pulmonologists feel that they do better not being ventilated. So there's still more that needs to be investigated there. And then the next slide demonstrates just the age factor, which we are really very much aware of, that there is less improvement for that 70-year-old or above population. So in this, you know, trial, this study, they saw that 36 of 53 of those patients actually had clinical improvement. This is just a summary of all the adverse effects and events. You can see that most of the people had some issue, you know, more so in the invasive ventilation group than the non-invasive.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
And we can continue talking through, because some interesting things happened, I guess, at the beginning of this week around management guidelines. So the National Institute of Health offers some guidance around treatment. And if you just go to the next slide for me, Shane, you know, the summary doesn't really give us a lot of direction. I think we were still at this point where we pretty much have discussed many of these things. They do not recommend the use of pre-exposure prophylaxis. They do not recommend post-exposure prophylaxis at this time. And they do not, the panel recommends no additional laboratory testing and no specific treatment for persons with suspected or confirmed asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic COVID-19. And at present, there are no drugs that have been proven to be safe and effective, meaning that all the clinical trials are still ongoing. And even though we have that emergency authorization, that drug, the hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine have not been proven to be effective. If we keep going further, the Infectious Disease Society of America also put out some guidelines, which I thought were very interesting because they put out part one of their guidelines. So part two and part three are still to come, sort of like a movie sequel, or I guess the Marvel Universe, where we're going to be anticipating these additional treatment and guidelines. To be fair, there is a significant knowledge gap, so it is hard to say what really does work because we are actively doing the clinical trials. So if you go to the next slide, you see that all of these recommendations, and I'm not going to read through all of them, they recommend, though, that these drugs can be given in the context of a clinical trial. So that is all secondary to the fact that we do not have enough clinical data. We do not have enough evidence to support the use of one treatment regimen. What I want to talk about next is, you know, really thinking about what will tomorrow bring. So looking at some emerging research, the first thing I want to talk about is the announcement that came out from Mayo Clinic. This came out a few weeks ago that they were investigating convalescent plasma as a therapy. And I think we've talked about it on and off. You know, there's been a lot of articles that have mentioned it, but you know, Mayo Clinic is really leaning into this, and they are now, they've organized a study. As of yesterday, they had 1,600 facilities, 1,600 facilities participating in the study, and they have over 1,000 patients. That's like 2,200 doctors who are all participating in this clinical trial. They're looking at the benefits of convalescent plasma, which, as you know, is the antibodies from individuals who have had the virus and now have recovered and successfully recovered from the virus. So it is a blood transfusion, and they are able to just use the plasma. And they are looking at if this is a possible therapy for COVID-19. We have seen success with convalescent plasma and Ebola virus treatment, so it's sort of along that logic. But it's really interesting, 1,600 facilities, over 1,000 patients, so looking forward to seeing what comes of that. The other studies that are ongoing that I wanted to mention is around a BCG vaccination. There are currently two clinical trials looking at this, and the World Health Organization put out a statement about this because they wanted to make sure that we are all aware that we're not recommending everybody go out and get BCG vaccinations, which is for tuberculosis. But what they have found is that in those countries where we're still seeing the use of BCG vaccinations because of the high incidence of tuberculosis, they have seen a lower incidence the incident of COVID-19 positive cases. So more to come on that, you know, really waiting to see what happens around those clinical trials. The last thing that I want to talk about is some of the lessons learned. And we have, I think, continuously discussed to exhaust, you know, preparedness and facility readiness. And we need to think about this as we are seeing the relaxation of some of our current rules, you know, social distancing rules, and we start getting back to the business of the country, of running the country. We need to really think about how do we protect our facilities and what do we need to track for, so that facility readiness for us doesn't go away even as we see less new cases coming about. We always have to be ready. I think it's something that we're going to have to make sure is part of our ongoing plan for the rest of our careers. So when we're looking at this, you know, the CDC is warning of a second wave. There are things that we have to do, and I think this study really speaks to what happened with those first few facilities in King County. It looks at, if you proceed, it looks at the way people were moving in, healthcare personnel and visitors and the traffic between the facilities. And, you know, they were able to just really look in and at who was, where the possible vectors, you know, were coming from. So they identified those confirmed COVID-19 cases linked to the first facility with the outbreak. And that first outbreak was on February 28th, where they saw the first case. By March 18th, there were 30 long-term care facilities reporting a case. So you can just see and get a sense of how we've seen the transmission of this. Some facilities sharing the healthcare workers, whether in that healthcare personnel bucket, it included physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and physicians, as well as your physical therapist, speech therapist, occupational therapist, nursing staff. Everyone was included in that healthcare worker. You saw that they were moving to and between different facilities. Patients were being transferred, and we were able to just get a timeline of how things were moving throughout this area. So King County, the Public Health Department out of Seattle, and the CDC really launched an investigation and started doing contact tracing to see how everything was moving. And, you know, it really, really makes us have to think about what does the future need to look like when we are planning for the next potential wave or the next outbreak in our facilities. You know, there has been a lot of conversation around the small outbreaks that we're yet to see happening around where the nursing facility is the primary setting for these outbreaks. But this is a really good study. You know, we need to know how the spread is occurring, and we have to think about how we include that into our quality improvement. And with that, I know we had a couple of questions come through, so we're going to open it up to open discussion. So Dr. Padilla, you had a question about ivermectin. It can inhibit viral counts. Okay, please ask. Yes.
Yeah. There have been some interesting just reports, and ivermectin is FDA approved for scabies and parasitic infections. And right now, I was just looking up the just in vitro studies, it can reduce viral counts 5,000 fold. And I haven't done enough research about, you know, case reports. But I'm just wondering, for patients that we elect to keep in the facility, if that's worth a try. And the other, just a comment, is I know because of my husband's a radiologist, and they're seeing acute presentation of COVID in the form of, you know, large vessel, like middle cerebral artery infarcts and pulmonary emboli. So that goes with what you were presenting earlier about, you know, the coagulopathy and maybe antiphospholipid antibodies being present. So just the spectrum of presentations changing. So I'll stop right there. Thanks.
And I don't have any response. I just think that's very interesting. If you could share what you're reading, I think we would greatly appreciate it. There was a question from Dr. Edwards on should we give Plavix or Xarelto to prevent clotting? I believe Dr. Padilla answered your question, Dr. Edwards. And the one that we're seeing the thermal prophylactic that we're seeing mostly recommended is IV heparin. Dr. Reyes has a question.
So quick question, are we going to try to maybe push towards universal testing, now Medicare is saying, I think that the number that was in was $100 per test. So the funding is there, at least for the Medicare patients, but also for the Medicaid or non-Medicare overall, maybe trying to push through the health department for universal testing of everybody in skilled nursing and actually the entire facility, long and short-term patients.
Yeah, so I don't know if anyone else on the line has any clear answers around that. I would say that, every society paper I've seen, a position has been in support of more availability of testing and making sure that the facilities have the availability of testing. So if anyone else knows anything else, I welcome you to answer Dr. Reyes' question.
So Diane, this is Joe Auslander.
Yes.
Hi, Diane. First of all, thank you.
Hi, Dr. Auslander.
Thank you for your fantastic updates and the way you put them together. Just two comments. One is I've been on some emails with Mike Wasserman, who is the president of the California Long-Term Care Association, AMDA affiliate in California, who's been very proactive with his organization and trying to work with the state and the QIO to make recommendations. And his feeling is that their feeling is that you should do testing in everyone, in residents and staff. I've also been in touch with Chuck Pugh, who Dr. Reyes knows from Massachusetts, who was asked to prepare a facility to receive all COVID positive patients. And they tested 97 asymptomatic residents and 50 or 75 staff, and 54 of the residents were positive and 40% of the staff were positive. And there are other reports like that. 20 of the people who were initially asymptomatic when they did this went on to die. And his strong feeling is that testing everyone could be confusing at this point. And my own thought about this is that we should really lobby hard to get the staff tested and tested repeatedly, because they're the main unknown vector that's going to continue to bring the virus into facilities, and the testing has to be repeated. And there's a false negative test rate as well. We've already made recommendations, I think, that say that anyone who comes into a facility from a hospital should be treated as if they have the infection. Maybe if they don't have symptoms and they've had two negative tests, it's safe. But even if they have one negative test or don't have any symptoms and have no negative tests, in my mind, they ought to be treated as if they have the infection. So I'm not clear in my own mind about testing all the residents, but repeated testing of staff, I think, is going to be essential. And if I could take one more moment to comment on one of the articles that you picked out, which I think is very important, just the one on co-infection. So that was a very good article, but it to me, it didn't address what's going to become a very critical clinical question in as we go into a season when we have a influenza vaccine and maybe or maybe not a COVID vaccine. And that is, if you are influenza positive, what's the co-infection rate with COVID? So if you see a patient with respiratory symptoms and you get a rapid flu test in a skilled nursing facility, what's the chance that they could also have COVID? To me, that's the one of the real clinically important questions. So again, thank you for doing all this.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your comments. I think that's the things that we need to start thinking about. I know that there was another question about in patients donating serum for convalescent plasma treatment, are they tested to make sure that there's no virus present or shedding still occurring? I do not have the answer for that. I think those are the questions that we're hoping that will be, you know, if somebody else may have seen an article about this. I'm not sure yet of if they're positive, if they're showing no detectable virus. But it's a question I'm hoping that we're going to get answered with some of the things that Mayo Clinic is doing in that trial. And I believe there was another question just about anybody having any difficulties with facilities not allowing participation to telehealth. I asked that to the broader audience, and I will make the comment that not all facilities are at the same place. We know that we have a lot of facilities that are not as, I'm trying to be fair and political here, but we know we have a lot of facilities that are not able to organize and coordinate these things the same. So it really is going to take our leadership to get them at the place where they're able to allow for the facilities to participate, the providers to participate in telehealth. We need to ask questions about who would be the person who holds the iPad or the phone for those patients who do not have that technology. Do not even have a phone in the room. You know, there are a lot of questions. So you know your facilities, and I would really think that we need to do a telehealth assessment that may look a little bit different for a facility versus a hospital. And we as an organization should probably be defining what a telehealth assessment for a nursing facility and an assisted living facility should look like. Let's see. What other questions still around the utilization of Plaquenil, hydroxychloroquine? There is no supportive literature to say that you should be doing this. This really comes down to a clinical decision. You know, we've seen some people who responded very well to it and others who have not. If you're doing it in a nursing facility, you really need to think about what your facility can and cannot do, because you need to check an EKG before starting and you need to check an EKG afterwards. And you really need to monitor that, because we do know the impact that it has on QT prolongation.
Dr. Sanders DePeta.
Yes.
Had one more question from the chat. How long after infection is IgG elevated in consideration of testing for convalescents in patients that were suspected to have been COVID positive but never got tested when ill?
Yeah, I don't know yet. I think that's a very interesting question. That's a question that we're trying to find the answer to. I'm very curious to see if it's something that we can use to identify immunity and what immunity looks like. IgG, is a marker of having an older infection. It may mean that you are, you've been exposed to it maybe 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. So, you know, when you're looking at it, so IgM, 10 days, 3 weeks, IgG positive with older infection. I don't know how long we're going to see it because the testing, the studies still have yet to come. And if someone else has a different answer, please chime in.
When is it safe for the patient to return to work?
We really have to follow the CDC guidance as far as when it is safe for the healthcare workers to come, provided that they have like PPE. You know, they're really saying after a negative test, they could go back. But there is evidence that we're still seeing viral shedding in stool samples and in sputum samples for 40 plus days. So, you know, I don't have a clear answer. I would just say we have to follow what the CDC guidelines are saying now about, you know, negative tests, five to, you know, you can return to work with no symptoms, negative tests. If you have not been tested, you really have to self isolate for 14 days, and provided that there are no symptoms, then you can return to work. That's the latest guidance I saw from the CDC. If anybody else has any other questions, please let me know, or any other comments to that. You may have something that I'm not aware of.
Thank you.
We had a question from Dr. Edwards about how many centers are treating patients with plasma treatments. How much plasma will the patient receive per donation? I think those are still questions that we're also identifying. I don't know of any facilities in Broward County doing it. I know that they're doing it in Miami-Dade County here in Florida. And I know that, you know, some of the bigger centers are looking into this as well.
Diane, this is Joe Alexander again. Diane?
Yes, I'm here. Yes.
Joe. Just a comment to the previous question. So I got some graphs from Chuck Pugh, who, you know, was doing all the testing in the facility in Massachusetts with Massachusetts General Hospital. And I honestly can't tell whether these are stylized diagrams or real data from his experience. But just in answer to the questions about the antibody, there are still a lot of questions, but in his, at least, diagram, it shows that the IgM antibody peaks at between 1 and 2 weeks and goes out to 28 days. And the IgG antibody starts at day 7 and goes out to past 42 days. I don't think anybody knows what that means, though, whether that creates immunity in an individual person or whether their convalescent plasma would be effective in treating the disease. But those are the more typical timelines of those antibodies.
Thank you, Dr. Auslander. Thank you very much for that. So do we have any other questions, or anybody want to make any comments?
Are there any valid tests right now for immunity from the chat, Dr. Sinister?
I think, well, there are... So as Dr. Alcindor mentioned, there are tests where we can check for antibodies now that are becoming available, serology testing, but, you know, I don't know, we don't know everything that it's going to mean, you know, so we don't know the viral shedding question. We don't know some of the other things that are coming forth. So there are testing, though, that can look at antibody testing, and I believe that many of that's becoming more available every week, I would say, you know. So I think that is the basis of the home test that they're trying to that they've approved it or trying to push through, so that the people in the general public can purchase and then resubmit to their insurance. There was a question. Or a comment that I believe Miranda Murrow, Dr. Murrow's system is involved in convalescent plasma use. So they have provided 2 units to patients so far. Well, interesting. I think everything is just really, we're really seeing like the beginning of some really interesting research. There are, like I said, multiple clinical trials that are out. This is going to be with us for some time, where we're going to be seeing emerging information come through. Thank you all for attending. Thank you guys for your support as we do these presentations. Thank you for what you're doing for our post-acute long-term care patients. You know, it is such a difficult time, and I just want to, you know, having been on both sides now of, I guess, of this disease, not positive for myself, but having family members impacted, it is really important what we're doing and the fact that we're providing the care to our facilities and helping them and helping our patients, whether you're doing your visits face-to-face, telehealth, you know, everything that we're doing matters. And I just would like to just thank you all for all of the hard work through this crisis. Thank you.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.